Welcome back to Crime Session, you guys. I am so glad you're here, and I want to tell you that if you didn't listen to episode 2 about Christine Paolilla, go back and listen to it because that one was just crazy and sad all at the same time, and I promise you will not be disappointed. I'm going to share a little information about myself just so that you know, and I'm sharing this because I went back and listened to my first episode about Laura Ayala, and I could totally tell I was not comfortable at all in talking to you guys and recording these podcasts. I'm an extremely shy person. I actually first thought about doing YouTube videos, like a YouTube crime series, but there is no way in hell I'm gonna be able to show my face because I am just that freaking shy. Anyways, I wanna tell you guys that I am not a professional. I don't have any experience in investigative journalism or radio or anything like that. I am literally just a person who loves true crime. When I was little, I wanted to be a police officer because I ultimately wanted to become a homicide detective. And I was also interested in the forensic side of things, but that's not what happened for me. I am a medical student now, and I think that's where I belong. But true crime, my love for true crime has never left. It's always been there. It's always been something that I was very interested in. So I decided, what the hell? Let's start a podcast, right? So that's just a little FYI about me in case you were wondering. Anyways, let's get on with the episode, guys. This episode is going to be a little different than my previous two since these cases are so short due to lack of information. I'm actually combining several cases into one episode. All of the information in this podcast was gathered solely from internet sources, and I try my very best to include only the facts. This podcast may contain explicit content, including rape and murder. Listener discretion is advised. This first case that I'm going to talk about is the unsolved murder of 10-year-old Amberly Ann Mendoza. I have to start out by saying that there is hardly any information at all about this case, and because the one news station that covered it back in the 90s has changed website servers, the news links don't work. I'm not super techie. I'm going to assume it's the servers, but whenever I click the link, it says that it doesn't exist and that the site has moved or something like that. I don't know. But that's what it is. There's not a lot of info, so I'm going to share with you what I could find. All right, so Amberly was a 10-year-old little girl, and her family said that she was shy, that she loved drawing, and her favorite food, just like most kids, was pizza. So on March 8, 1996, Amberly's family was having a barbecue at her home in Yuma, Arizona. They said that around 11:30 p.m., Amberly got tired and she went to her room to play with Barbie dolls, and she went to sleep soon after. The next morning, around 10:45 a.m., her mom went to her room to wake her up for breakfast, but she discovered Amberly's lifeless body instead. Amberly had been raped and suffocated with her own pillow. During the investigation, police didn't find any forced entry, but they did find DNA. The night of the barbecue, the night of the murder, several families had stayed over, and they were all cleared of having any involvement in the crime, and police were able to confirm that a non-family member was responsible for her death. Amberly's older sister Jordan said that the girls often left their bedroom window unlocked and sometimes would climb in and out of it and use it as a door. And the way their house was set up, their bedroom was in the front of the house, so anyone passing by could clearly see the girls jumping in and out of it and maybe even not locking it up. It's also possible that sometimes they wouldn't close it at all. This is not something that I can say is totally confirmed, but I read somewhere that Amberly had left her window open the night of the murder for fresh air. Not sure if that's true, but it's possible they were, you know, using it as a door. They wouldn't lock it. They're kids. Kids could sometimes be careless and probably not, close it. So, moving on, the family reported that suspicious activity around the house had been happening in the weeks leading up to the murder. Listen to some of her sister's 2016 interview.
There was a few nights where she woke me up and said, "Jordan, there's somebody outside our window." And I said, "What? What are you talking about? Like you're probably just hearing some kind of noise." She goes, "No, Jordan, I saw someone. I heard this like horrific scream right outside our house. And it scared me. And me and my sister, we ran to the window to see what was going on. And we see these two guys. And one guy's like, "Come on, dude, we gotta get out of here. Come on, hurry up, dude, hurry up." And then the other guy's like, "Dude, just calm down. Just calm down. Just walk slow." Again, like being a little kid, I didn't think to say anything to anybody.
Her sister Jordan also says that the same day of the murder, she and her aunt were pulling up to Amberly and Jordan's home, and they saw two men sitting in a vehicle in the driveway. But as soon as the men saw Jordan and her aunt, they immediately left. And I forgot to mention, Amberly had two sisters. I know one was Jordan, and I'm not sure of the other one's name. But that night, the two sisters spent the night at their grandma's house. So no one was there in the room because the girls did share a room. But no one else was in the room. It was just Amberly that was there that night. And that's really all we have about this case. I told you it was super short. There's really not hardly any information at all. I don't feel like the sightings of these creepy men were a coincidence at all. And this case really gives me the creeps, to be honest. I wish these girls would have said something to their parents and maybe the outcome would have been different. All those things that happened, and not one time did Amberly or Jordan tell their parents, "Hey, there was these weird dudes outside of, you know, the house, and they've seen them several times," but no one ever said anything. I am a crime nerd to the max, so I'm constantly looking over my shoulder, and I've even taught my own kids how important it is to be aware. I also triple check my doors and windows at night because I'm just that terrified of something like this happening. Guys, talk to your kids. Let them know that anytime anything weird or unusual or creepy happens, that they gotta tell you. It's super important. So if you or anyone you know have any information regarding Amberly's death, please call 928-782-7463. This next case is going to be the unsolved murder of Alexandra Anaya. Alexandra went by the name Alex. She was from Hammond, Indiana, and she was 13 years old. She was very involved in school sports. She did cross country, and her mom said that she played soccer very well. When she grew up, she wanted to be a veterinarian. She loved animals so very much, she even volunteered at the local animal shelter. They described her as being kind, gentle, sweet, loving, helpful. Her two little sisters that she had at the time were 6 years old, and they said that she just loved those girls with all her heart. She cooked for them, cleaned up after them. They said that she would even teach them how to spell and help them with homework and things like that. She helped her mom with those girls very much, from what I read. So, let's get into the case. So, on August 12th, 2005, it seems that Alex, her mother Sandra, and her two little sisters ate dinner, and Sandra decided that she was going to go out for the night. Just so that you know, I am not sure whether or not the mom was going on a date, whether or not she was going out with friends or family. I don't know. I just know that she left Alex and the two little girls there while she went out. Reports say that Sandra returned really early in the morning of the 13th, so around 3 or 4 a.m. And it gets a little confusing, but reports say that she saw Alex and she spoke to Alex, and that Sandra left again. She left the home again. She told Alex that she was leaving, but that she would be back shortly. When she did return about 3 hours later, Sandra said that the door was unlocked and Alex was gone. Her two sisters were there, but there was no sign of Alex. She immediately, you know, searched the house, and she went outside. She looked outside. She couldn't find her. So she said that she called the police. On August 16, 2005, a torso was found floating in the Little Calumet River in Chicago, Illinois. The torso was just that. It was a torso and it was attached to a chain with a cement block. There was no head, no arms, no legs. Whenever Sandra found out about this discovery, she let the police know that Alex had a scar on her chin and she had a sprained ankle, but at this point she was unaware that the body was so badly dismembered. And about 3 weeks later, DNA tests confirmed that the torso did belong to Alex. During the investigation, the police find out that Sandra had a 9-year relationship with a man named Rodolfo Heredia. He wasn't Alex's father, but he and Sandra did have the two younger girls together. The couple had an on-again, off-again type of relationship, but just 4 months before Alex's murder, Alex told her mom that Rodolfo had been sexually abusing her since she was 7 years old. So, in April of 2005, Sandra leaves Rodolfo for good, but he then starts to stalk the family. He's calling them constantly. He starts following them around, watching their house. He made copies of their keys, and he was even found inside their apartment after the breakup. Eventually, Rodolfo is arrested, but he's arrested for stalking. And even though he admits to police that he followed them around, that he was calling them nonstop, he admitted to making copies of their house keys without permission, he was acquitted. And just to mention to you guys, Alex's body was actually found only a block and a half from where Rodolfo lived at the time of the murder. Sandra believes that she knows exactly who's responsible for her daughter's murder, but there just isn't any evidence to prove it. In 2016, the FBI took a look at the case and they now have control over it, and they're offering a $10,000 reward for any evidence that could close this case. So call the FBI with any information at 312-421-6700. Okay, guys, so this is the last case that I'm going to share on this episode, and this is the unsolved murder of Hannah Truelove. So Hannah was a 16-year-old girl. She was from Gatesville, Georgia. She was described as your average teenager. She was popular, fun, compassionate, and everything about her was just totally normal. So in the weeks leading up to her death, Hannah had made several tweets about a possible stalker that she may have had. So on August 23rd, 2012, it started as a normal day for Hannah and her mom. Her mom was divorced from Hannah's father, but I think that they were still very much in contact for Hannah. So she went to school that day, but she made it back home just like any other day, and there's proof of that. Her mom said that there is proof because there was mail that was brand new. So it seemed that Hannah had checked the mail and brought it home, but she just figured that she wasn't, when her mom got home, she figured that she wasn't there. You know, she's a teenager. She was probably out, you know, hanging out with her friends or something like that. So, Mona, her mother, decided to take a nap and she assumed that Hannah would be there by the time she woke up, but she wasn't. Let me say this. Hannah didn't have her phone. I am not sure why it was taken from her. I can't find information on that anywhere. But when her mom woke up, Hannah wasn't there. So instead of calling Hannah, Mona called Hannah's dad to see if Hannah was probably with him. But he told her that no, she wasn't with him. So she begins, you know, calling Hannah's friends, you know, just trying to figure out where Hannah is. But she couldn't find her at all. Nobody had known anything about where Hannah might have been after school. So her mom starts worrying, of course, and she decides to call the police to make a police report. The next day comes and goes, and there's still no sign of Hannah. But eventually that day, Mona gets a knock at the door, and it's from the police, but it's not the news she wanted to hear. The police tell Mona that Hannah's body had been discovered just a quarter mile away from her apartment complex and that she had been stabbed to death. During the investigation, the police try to find evidence, you know, at the crime scene. But the night that Hannah went missing, there was a thunderstorm. So any forensic evidence that could have been left behind was destroyed by the rainwater. So police dig into Hannah's life a little more, and they actually put their focus on the tweets that Hannah made. But the person that Hannah was talking about was eventually cleared, and they say that that person had nothing to do with Hannah's murder. They end up finding that Hannah actually spent her afternoon after school in the courtyard area of the apartment complex. From what it seems, there was, you know, an apartment complex, and there was a huge grassy area, and a lot of people spent time there. There, you know, that's where kids would go and play, families would go, you know, fly kites with their kids, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that day, there were a lot of kids there and families also. So police start talking to people, and one of the witnesses said that they saw a silver vehicle pull up with a few dudes in it. One black male got out of the passenger door and walked toward the tree line out of sight. So about 15 minutes later, he said he saw the same male walking out of the area, but with Hannah walking behind him. So then Hannah and the male walk across the parking lot towards the wooded area where she was later found dead. Okay, and I'm not sure if this is the same witness as they were talking to before, but a witness says that they do see Hannah alive about an hour after she's seen walking towards the wooded area. So she's seen with the male. They go off. She is seen about an hour later alive. And then she's found dead back in that same area. And you guys, again, that is the only information that we have in this case. There is really not a lot to go on, and police have been trying, and they have exhausted their leads, but they have not given up. They are still on the case. I think the original investigator is still on the case. He's not giving up. But police don't think that this attack was random at all. They think that Hannah definitely knew who her killer was. And the way she was killed, you know, was by stabbing. And I'm sure that you've heard, stabbings are personal attacks. A lot of the times, you know, it's a crime of passion, or, you know, they really, really, really hate that person. So they don't think it's random. If you have any information on who killed Hannah Truelove, or if you have any information at all, please call police and let them know. Let's get these families some closure, guys. So that's all I have for you today, guys. I'm not going to give my opinions on the last two episodes, but I will say that if you know anything at all, or if you know somebody that knows something, I really hope that you find it in your hearts to reach out and do the right thing and get these families some closure for their daughters. They've been waiting for so long, and they deserve it, and you deserve to get it off your chest as well. So until next time, be safe.